Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And everybody should master Neely Fuller's, you know, behavior code. Stop name calling, stop gossiping, stop squabbling, stop cursing, stop being discourteous, stop being disrespectful to one another, stop stealing from one another, stop robbing one another, stop fighting one another, and stop killing one another. And the ones that I add to it, stop using and selling drugs to one another. See, we're getting ready to be put in a real trap with this legalization of marijuana. So everybody, every black person can be unemployed, and then they can sit in their corner and get high on marijuana with whatever they decide to put in it. And people won't be asking for jobs and being determined that they're going to get jobs and going to get an education. No, everybody can start getting high on marijuana, because somebody said it's medicinal and it's legal.
What about,
so we better beware.
What about the people who say the legalization of marijuana is fighting against racism because you have so many black people who are unjustly incarcerated as a result of racist enforcement of these drug laws? So this would be a good thing, and it would keep black people out of greater confinement.
No, we can do it by stop using and selling drugs to one another. See, if I'm not using drugs, then I can't be incarcerated for drugs. And I see so many males, young males in my practice who have become psychotic, almost never to return to normal from marijuana use, because you don't know what's in it. You don't know how it's been genetically altered. Again, everything has to be put in the context of a power dynamic system of racism and white supremacy. That's one thing the president spoke of, looking at behavior in context. Now, whether he actually meant context, as I say it, I say the context is a system of racism and white supremacy. That's the only way we're going to understand any aspect of our behavior, the power context in which the behavior occurs.
Just for our listeners, because I think that's real important, I had only heard a few people who were saying, who had suspicion about this sudden push to legalize marijuana, and saying, I don't think that this is being done with the best intentions for black people. Are you saying that you think that this could be something to further erode black people's will and ability to replace white supremacy with justice? So we're just all
absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. See, they drug test to deny you employment. And so now I'm going to tell you, you can get all the marijuana you want. See, we have to say, well, this is interesting. They're legalizing marijuana use, and they're closing schools. They're legalizing marijuana use, but they are making it difficult for black people to vote. They're legalizing marijuana, but they are tightening up on affirmative action. They're legalizing marijuana, but they're making it more difficult to prove discrimination in employment. So again, see, understanding system, and this is how come our brains push black people to say, hey, what's happening? That's not an idle question. The brain is saying, you don't really understand what's going on. Keep asking, what's happening? What's happening? Maybe somebody will be able to tell you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, March 9th, 2016. So I have been told. We just did our 7-year anniversary here at the Cows, and I think our caller in Michigan, she asked, why is this program named Context of White Supremacy? That is sterling illustration right there from Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing. That sound clip, that's from 2013, her 21st visit to the Cows out of 31. And just to timestamp it, that is 7 days after the conclusion of the Trayvon Martin murder trial when she was on the program. I hadn't thought of it at the time. However, 7 days from the Trayvon Martin murder trial, Trayvon Martin's alleged cannabis use was a significant factor in the trial, if I do remember, at least in the perception and how people talked about what happened. Dare I say, even justifying George Zimmerman killing Trayvon Martin. My memory might be faulty, though. The broadcast today, I said at the beginning of the year that certainly we were going to take due diligence to remember the monumental counter-racist effort of third-generation physician and author Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing. Thankfully, she was on the program many times. And also, as I've said consistently, she left a massive, astronomical amount of work for us to continue to study and hone our understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and just concepts, information to help us solve this problem. That is what she would want us to do, I think. She also left a lot of students, folks who invested a good bit of time and energy studying with Dr. Welsing, being fortunate enough to attend her institute, the Cress-Welsing Institute in Washington, D.C., on the Coward, on the campus of Howard University. A lot of folks were able to attend, some for many years, to just soak up as much content as possible. And we thought it would be fantastic. Actually, one of our listeners has been super helpful, same listener who pitched in and helped us get Dr. Welsing's sister, Lauren Cress Love, on the program earlier this year, who just had a wealth. I mean, it was astronomical to just be able to talk to her and get more background information about Dr. Welsing's family and how she got to this point. It was just a real pleasure to listen to her. I would encourage folks to go back and listen to the archives. But he also thought it would be great to get one of her students on the program as well. Ironically, I already knew of this person's work before the Cows even existed. I used to spend a good chunk of time listening to Mr. Edward Williams' counter-racism.org, his counter-racism radio network. I would listen. They had a lot of archives with Mr. Fuller, Dr. Welsing, and he played an interview with our guest this evening, an interview that she did with the admitted white supremacist Farrell Winfrey from some years ago. And I listened to that and was like, wow, I've got to get this Farrell Winfrey on our program. If we get a broadcast going, I would enjoy having her as a guest on the program to ask a few questions and to ask, you know, in a similar serious manner as our guest on the program for this evening did. She was very serious, right to the point. I think she had even worked with Dr. Welsing and some others to really precision craft some great questions. I would encourage folks to check it out. It's actually linked in the description for the program this evening if folks want to take a listen. But I'd heard her in the archives participating in various counter-racist talks and just thought, wow, it'll be great to have her on the program to give her thoughts, impressions of Dr. Welsing's work and some of her own views on the system of white supremacy. Joining us live, one of Dr. Welsing's students, long-running students at the Welsing Institute, Miss Sabrina Johnson. Miss Johnson, are you with us?
Yes, yes. Peaceful greetings to you.
Greetings. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Wednesday evening. Real pleasure to have you speak with us this evening. For our listeners, this might be their first time hearing from you, Sabrina. Anything that you think would be significant for folks to know about who you are, the work that you do?
Sure. I would characterize myself. Well, first of all, can you hear me well?
You are crystal.
Okay, great. I would characterize myself as a longtime devoted student of Dr. Welsing, and I feel so grateful that I had the opportunity to walk with her, so to speak, for so long and so closely. I think that my own upbringing, my own personal constitution, the experiences that I had in, through my childhood and into my young adulthood kind of made me ripe to really latch on to her analysis and teachings. So I think that explains why I've been so, just closely in tune with countering racism and her analysis of what is the motivating driving factor for the behaviors that we see consistently by people who classify themselves as white all over the world.
Right on. You are a black female, for folks who have not seen you?
Correct.
Right on. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, use the terms racism and white supremacy as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white, who are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Absolutely, the system exists. And I would say I would not characterize that definition as inaccurate. I would say not quite comprehensively complete.
Anything you would add, or if you want to give us your own definition?
Well, I think that if we look to Dr. Welsing's functional definition, it is comprehensive because it addresses the what, the who, the when, the where, and the why of the system. And because of our victimization over generations and generations and generations, there's so much in us that serves as a barrier and an obstacle from even accepting the truth of the reality that we exist within. Because of that, I think that a full comprehensive definition that hits all of those critical points is best. It's that locks it up, you know. It's unrefuted, as is her crest theory of color confrontation. It's just so complete and correct and accurate and solid that, I mean, who can go behind that with an effective challenge? You can't, and that's what counter-racist codification is really all about.
For sure. I think she emphasized that pretty consistently when she would read her total definition. And I think she had a cash reward if someone could come behind and give a better definition for racism, white supremacy. To my knowledge, no one ever stepped forward to claim their cash reward for having a more thorough definition for racism, white supremacy.
Right. And that's something that, you know, I've been doing in all of the tributes or the remarks concerning sort of this new reality that we're adjusting ourselves to in terms of her physical absence, but to always read very precisely her definition so that there's clarity, and to also, you know, make a correction that lots and lots and lots and lots of people always make. They say racism and white supremacy, which indicates a lack of understanding of what the system of white supremacy is, of what racism is, because they are one and the same. So I'm sort of quick to point that out in a respectful way.
Right on. Definitely. That is hugely important. Just that little conjunction has a big impact when racism, white supremacy are not equated. They are, as you said, one and the same. Did you want to read Dr. Welsing's definition, if you have it on hand, that just to make sure everybody is clear about what she stated?
Sure. Okay. Functional definition of racism equals white supremacy equals apartheid. Racism, white supremacy is the local and global power system and dynamic structured and maintained by persons who classify themselves as white, whether consciously or subconsciously determined, which consists of patterns of perception, logic, symbol formation, thought, speech, action, and emotional response, as conducted simultaneously in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war, for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth, a planet upon which the vast and overwhelming majority of people are classified as non-white, black, brown, red, and yellow, by white-skinned people. And all of the non-white people are genetically dominant in terms of skin coloration compared to the genetic recessive white-skinned people. And let me just add a couple of other paragraphs of further context that Dr. Welsing shared concerning that definition. The system of racism, white supremacy, utilizes deceit and violence, inclusive of chemical warfare, biological warfare, and psychological warfare, indeed any means necessary to achieve its ultimate goal objective of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth. In the existing system of racism, white supremacy, when the term is undefined and poorly understood, there is general confusion and chaos on the part of the victims of that system, local, national, and global. It then becomes impossible for the victims of racism, white supremacy, to effectively counter the global system of racism, white supremacy. The African enslavement, imperialism, colonialism, neocolonialism, fascism, etc., are all dimensions and aspects of the system of racism, white supremacy. So she even gave some further context to your leading question about the definition of racism, white supremacy.
For sure, the cows. What, just so listeners have a better grasp, you said that you felt like your experiences as a black female in this context prior to knowing about Dr. Welsing's work, her theory of white genetic annihilation, that your life experience prepared you to receive Dr. Welsing's teaching. Just can you kind of give us an idea of what that experience was like?
Sure. I grew up in a rather small town in South Carolina. And I do recall that my older sister used to call me militant before I even knew what the word meant. So there was, I guess, always a little something there. But I remember specific experiences. I remember being in fifth grade and learning about Egyptians. And nobody told me this, and it certainly wasn't explained, or nor had I seen images. But somehow I just knew that they were black. I have that memory in my head. Let's see, there were, I think, six black students, including myself, my sister, and my cousin, at the elementary school, and went to K through sixth grade. So I had a lot of interaction with white students, and all of the teachers were white. So through that experience, I got, you know, a significant dose of victimization along the way. Fortunately, I had a strong home setting with parents who, you know, could secure me emotionally and all of that. So I loved learning, and I did well academically. But there are always these things that popped up. You know, my mother would share her experiences, you know, going to the bank, and always the attempts to cheat her just consistently. Like every week something would happen. Things would happen when you go to the store. Things would happen on the job with my father, et cetera, et cetera. So I knew things were out of balance in many ways. And then as an adolescent, the one event that I think had more impact on me than anything in my life was that a classmate's father was lynched. And this was the late 70s, and there was rumor of course, the classic rumor, him and some white woman. But nothing was done from my vantage point. There wasn't a full, thorough investigation. To my understanding, that the wooded area where his body was found hanging from a tree was bulldozed before there was the collection of evidence and all of that. And you know, I recall being extraordinarily angry and confused, but also it was a moment of truth for me. I determined or concluded in my mind right then that, wow, nobody really can protect anyone else. I'm on this path of life myself, and so I kind of view life from a vantage point of, you know, being very self-reliant and knowing that I need to analyze things for myself, understand things for myself, and just not rely on anyone else, including, you know, parents, leadership, authorities, etc. So, yeah, that was a sort of a monumental life experience. And so I was always asking, you know, why? Because all of these situations, I mean, they're countless situations that I could name growing up in a small town in South Carolina. And then going away to college in Baltimore, and then living in the Boston area for a number of years soon after graduating from college. So certainly that experience in the Boston area, which I call the Mississippi of the North, you know, had a big impact also. And I happened to be in the Boston area when the Charles Stewart case happened. And for folks who aren't aware, there's a white couple leaving a childbirth class. The husband's driving, the wife was seated next to him. She was 7 months pregnant, and the report that was released was that a black assailant broke into their car as they were at a red light in a black section, quote-unquote black section of Boston, and shot the woman, the pregnant white woman, and then also shot the husband in the abdomen. The white woman was killed. She was shot in the face. And so, of course, all hell broke loose because, you know, there was a description of the assailant. You know, he was wearing, of course, dark jogging clothing, and, you know, he was dark-skinned and all that sort of stuff. But basically, every black male was harassed, rounded up. Many were falsely, of course, accused and arrested and all of that. And it didn't matter how far away they were from the physical description of the alleged assailant. But what had really actually happened was this white man had shot his own 7 months pregnant wife in the face as she sat next to him in the car as they were leaving a childbirthing class. Then he had, to make the story believable, shot himself in the abdomen. Of course, he missed any vital organs, and had his brother meet him. It was prearranged. Take the gun, you know, take some jewelry to make it seem like it was a robbery and that sort of thing. And, yeah, Boston, the people who classified themselves as white in Boston really showed who they were in that aftermath. And soon the story seemed to unravel. Only after they had imprisoned a suspect and, you know, totally trashed his reputation, they had broken into even his mother's apartment and ransacked it, quote-unquote, looking for evidence. And he wasn't even the first suspect who was arrested. But the whole thing was a fabrication. And when they honed in on the true assailant, he jumped off a bridge and killed himself. So that's just one of the significant milestones in the Boston history of race relations. But that certainly had a big impact, and being there in the thick of it was quite interesting. This other thing happened months after that. I was in a jazz lounge, and there were two white males who appeared to be businessmen sitting nearby, and they were talking about the case and reflecting on it. And one of them said, you know, how tragic that was for the young wife. I think she was like 28 or 29, something like that. And this other of these two white businessmen said, well, she was 28 and a lawyer, so you know she was a bitch. And I was like, wow, these people are really, 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 really super-duper cold, cold-blooded.
Tackiness abounds every time South Carolina. Yeah. South Carolina pops up now, I'm obligated to mention Ben Tillman's name. He's the first name that pops to mind when I think of South Carolina. I guess eventually it'll be replaced with Dylan Storm Roof. But for now, it's Ben Tillman. And the threat of Negro domination hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. For folks who remember us reading, that was one of his classic lines out of many, former governor of South Carolina. Just all of those anecdotes, I mean, I think that right there, I think Dr. Welsing, when she says being able to connect the dots to understanding what happened to your friend or this black male who was lynched in high school, what happened to him, what happened with the situation in Boston, with Charles Stewart, even being able to blame a black person and it being believed immediately and the consequences for black people on the whole in that area. I think Dr. Welsing, when she talks about racism, white supremacy, it's moving beyond seeing each of these as just an anomaly. This is just an acute incident and, oh, this is bad for that one day. Understanding, no, this is a part of a greater context of why things happen on the planet and the power dynamic between white people, non-white people. I guess at what point did you bump into Dr. Welsing's work, and was it her book, or were you actually seeing her either in person or videos or hearing her, I guess, as well?
Yeah, and that's a question that I've asked myself, because they were all sort of around the very same time, very soon after the ISIS paper. Were published, and maybe before they before it got out widely in terms of wide circulation, I attended the National Black Holistic Retreat, which was a set of experiences that Brother Haki Mabuti, who is the founder of Third World Press, who published the ISIS papers, he and a number of other brothers had established these retreats to deal with the whole black person, meaning dealing with the cultural, historical, male-female relationships, nutrition, health, and dietary imperatives, all of that within a sort of a retreat setting. For a long weekend, and I had attended one of those, and the ISIS papers was, you know, newly minted. But I think I had actually heard her at a lecture, you know, prior to actually putting my hands on the book. And so, yeah, those happened in close proximity, and after that it was like, wow, wow, wow. So it was life-changing to really get an understanding of why, you know, what was really driving it.
Yeah. Hmm. Did it change when you got this information and understanding the why of racism, white supremacy? Did it change any of your behaviors or thought patterns in terms of how you functioned on the planet as a black female?
Yes, I think it cultivated more of a sense of patience and understanding with other black people and other non-white people, because, you know, if you fully understand the context of something, then certainly patience, I think, is a byproduct of that. And clarity on who is the enemy and who is not the enemy. So you get clear, or I got much clearer that, you know, you spend your ammunition on the sheriff, not the deputy, because if you waste it on the deputy, the sheriff remains and will just deputize someone else, you know, in their place. And as long as the system of racism, white supremacy exists, there will be people who are classified as non-white who, quote-unquote, score points for the other team. And that's just the nature of the system and the victimization. So there are probably times when you actually do have to defend yourself. However, keep in mind that other non-white people are not our enemy.
Very, very important. I know that comes up a lot on the program, how we respond with other victims of racism, where we don't agree with how they're responding to racism, white supremacy. Were you, I guess, in position to attend? I guess, when did you first start attending the actual Cress Welsing Institute in Washington, D.C.?
Well, actually, I started attending before I actually moved here. I had friends in the area, and I used to visit frequently, and I would align my my visits in accordance with the institute. So that would have been like the late, I guess the early 90s, maybe late 80s. Yeah, early 90s. And so over that time period, I can count on one hand the times that I have been absent from the institute meetings because of either being out of town. There was one time that I was sick. And but yeah, it's the institute itself, the Cress Welsing Institute of Psychiatry and Social Research, is it's just a phenomenal institute in that it's so many things in one. Yes, it was a lecture series. It was a learning lab, an actual laboratory where experiments are conducted, where you could view the lessons playing out. You could share information because, of course, you know, Dr. Welsing was a voracious reader, and she read multiple newspapers every day, but you can't read everything, every newspaper, and you can't watch every commercial. You can't see every billboard or read every magazine and see ads and photographs and that sort of thing. Excuse me, but when you have lots and lots of eyes and ears that are tuned to understanding the system and can pick up on things, people come to the institute and share, whether it's something they see in a store. This was so interesting. A few months ago, of course, you know, under the system of white supremacy, guns loom large. Well, most people are probably familiar with cookie cutters, you know, the little molds that you can shape your dough or your whatever into you know, certain shapes. So there was a pancake mold in the shape of a gun.
Wow.
That someone had seen in a store and brought in for quote-unquote show and tell, which is, you know, pretty deep. So, you know, the other thing we were able to observe, you know, Dr. Welsing in the institute, it was really a lecture series, the second Thursday of the month from 7 to 10 officially, from September through June every year, oftentimes even after we had to leave the space. We talk outside for another 2-3 hours or so because there's just so much to share about what's going on. But it was also the opportunity to learn by Dr. Welsing's demonstration, patience, understanding, asking the right probative questions, and also how to react when you're talking about the system of white supremacy and there are white people, people who classify themselves as white in the audience, in the setting, and seeing those interactions and that dynamic, which is very, very, very instructive. I'd say one of the things that I found most sort of satisfying is that in so many instances, people would bring in news articles or images or whatever, and they, in the most thorough way, demonstrated exactly what Dr. Welsing was explaining in terms of, especially subconscious thought and symbol formation, being able to decode what happens in the society, but all of the imagery and symbols that we see and don't understand and what their meaning could be. And it's just gratifying to see that over and over again. I recall one particular incident because it's kind of unusual in that one of the, Dr. Welsing would call them scouts, you know, people who are have a keen eye for spotting some aspect of the dynamic of white supremacy being played out in you know, whatever they're reading or watching, et cetera. So, and of course, Dr. Welsing didn't consume pornography, but at one point a student brought in a cartoon image from one of the porn magazines, and it was precisely how Dr. Welsing had characterized ball games. There it was, you know, in full visual context, you know, exactly what she explained, being in the subconscious mind, you know, driving the way ball games are played and what the various implements that are used, particularly in football, you know, what they mean from a sort of a psychosexual vantage point. So,
What was this exact? I know when she talks about football, before she talks about the goalpost representing the upright legs and the ball.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so what
yes,
was?
Yes. So there was a white man who was you know, in a reclined position, and he had this big brown, of course, football between his legs, and then the white woman. He was, you know, she had on a jersey, and her legs were positioned just like the upright goalpost, and they were both white in the imagery, and it was just precisely accurate.
Wow. Devastating illustration. A plus for Dr. Welsing on that one. That is.
Yes, indeed.
I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
You know, I did want to make a comment because in your opening segment, as you were playing Dr. Welsing's discussion of legalization of marijuana, I just wanted to share this because it was probably about a year or maybe a year and a half before the legalization debate really reached its peak in terms of really, really being considered by the quote-unquote mainstream, that I saw, and I just happened to see this article in, of all things, a AAA magazine, which, you know, the AAA auto service, whatever AAA, I forgot what it stands for, Automotive Association. And it was an article written by Pat Robertson, who is this, you know, ultra, quote-unquote, conservative, you know, white male. He heads the 700 Club, etc. And in this article, he was actually promoting legalization of marijuana. And, you know, I scratched my head. I rubbed my eyes. I read the thing again. It's like, what? wow. I mean, this, you know, lengthy column in this magazine that to me was not even, you know, relevant in terms of subject matter. But, you know, it was a huge question mark, and I called a couple of friends of mine and said that, and they were like, are you sure? It was unbelievable. But then, or now, looking back, I see it makes sense because there's this effort to push things in that direction. So I just wanted to share that. You know, they're working, the white supremacists are working not just 24/7 and in three shifts, as Dr. Wilson would say, but they're working 25/8. And so I think, you know, these strategies and tactics that they're using are, you know, well thought out, well in advance, and just kind of dropped out there, you know, at the right time.
Absolutely. The reason that I played that segment at the beginning was I was talking to a listener, and I said, when I say you all, I mean I'm in Washington State, so they have had legalization of cannabis since 2012 when President Obama was reelected. It all went at the same time, legalization of cannabis. I think they had big legislation about quote-unquote gay rights, and Obama was reelected all at the same time. So they had a huge party here in Seattle. And from that time, I said, I do not think, because they've been saying for 4 years now that legalization, this is a big way we can work against racism, so many black people, the war on drugs, it's been horrible, and this will help keep black people out of greater confinement. This will be great to go ahead and legalize. And I've been saying, from what I've seen, even my speculation before it happened, and certainly now, seeing how this has played out over 4 years, I was telling this listener, I said, man, you all have no idea what it's going to look like when you have a system of white supremacy and weed jelly beans and weed gummy bears. And the person laughed and they were like, ah, ha, ha. I mean, are you being serious, Gus? And I was like, yes, like you have no idea what this is going to look like as they proceed when you have weed gummy bears, weed jelly beans, which are already here. Weed soda, weed burritos, like just all of this stuff. And hey, this is legal. This is great. You can have a little fun. Like just no idea at all how this is going to particularly impact non-white people once this, you know, gets to be widely accepted and is beyond just Washington State and a few sort of places here and there. I know now Washington, D.C. is another spot where this has been legalized. The time that you've been there, how have you seen this evolve? And did Dr. Welsing comment on this?
Oh, sure. She's been sort of ringing the alarm bells for a long time on this. Because, yes, it's not just weed per se. These are you know, all kinds of, how is it that all of a sudden you have like 5 or 6 dozen different varieties? I mean, what really is that? Number one. Number two, what else is on it or in it? You know, most people don't know. And even if you're growing it, you don't know the origin of the seed. You don't know what's in the soil. I mean, there's plenty of opportunity for the white supremacists to taint, even at the genetic level, these plants, and then certainly from the more political and labor oriented perspectives, like Dr. Wilson was emphasizing. Yeah, so you're not going to have a job, and you can't be successful in, I won't say successful, you can't be effective as a partner in a relationship or parent or whatever, but just stay high.
Mm.
It also means that you're not going to be in a defensive posture, and anything goes under the system of white supremacy. You know, just push you out of the cities, put in a number of dog parks, bike lanes, and, 700 square feet condos that cost $800,000.
Absolutely. I remember a lot of people did not agree with her stance when she shared this back in 2013. They did not agree and had their own views, which is great. You know, we should all use our brain computer and come to logical conclusions. But one thing that I would consistently highlight, Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, a third generation physician, general and child psychiatrist, I don't think it should be glossed over when she said that she treated a number of patients, a sizable number of patients, who were exhibiting symptoms of psychosis as a result, what she thought was related to their marijuana consumption. I don't think that should be glossed over, taken lightly. This is not just someone off the street presenting information, third-generation physician, general and child psychiatrist saying, hey, I'm seeing psychosis that I think is related to marijuana consumption. I think that's just an additional one to ponder on, process as we try to make sense of all this. I know Dr. Welsing also, that's something that she had a big impact on me, among other areas as well, but certainly reading the newspaper, she would always talk about that, pay attention to what's going on. I know a number of times when I would call her, she would be watching the news constantly and just trying to get more information and seeing how that fit with her theory. So that's definitely one thing that I try to be relentless about, is checking the news constantly and reading many different sources to get information. I read this in the Washington Post just within the last couple of days, and I said, wow, this is right explicitly Dr. Welsing's theory of white genetic annihilation. I just want to read it really quick and get your thoughts. This post is in Washington, D.C., Reminders of America's Dark History of Segregation. Colbert I. King authored this piece. So he says, my recognition of African-American contributions began in the 1940s with annual celebrations of Negro History Week at Stevens Elementary School in my West End Foggy Bottom community. Our nation's capital is also where I experienced firsthand America's shame. Liberty Baptist Sunday School taught me the Ten Commandments. Civil authority in the city taught me the others. Among them, thou shalt not attend Grant Elementary School on G Street Northwest, which was for white children only. Thou shalt not attempt to enter the Circle Theater at 21st and Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, where only whites were allowed. Thou shalt never think about dining downtown. Thou can purchase sodas and sandwiches at the drugstore at the corner of 25th and Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, but thou shalt not sit and eat. Thou must stand at the end of the counter and wait patiently to be recognized. Ah, Washington of my youth, a place and time when skin color determined where you lived, attended school, worshipped and worked, and how much you could and how much you got paid. I learned that lesson as a teenager looking for part-time work. Pick up the January 3rd, 1960 edition of the Post, and what do you see? Boys, white, age 14 to 18, to assist route manager, full or part-time, must be neat in appearance, apply 1346 Connecticut Avenue Northwest. Drivers, truck, colored for trash routes, over 25 years of age, paid vacation, year-round work, must have excellent driving record, apply 1601 West Street, W Street Northeast. Students, boys, white, 14 years and over, jobs immediately available, apply at 724 9th Street, Ninth or Northwest. Simply stated, if you're black, get back. And I will stop there. Any remind you of Dr. Welsing in any way?
Absolutely. And you know, there's a continuum. You know, in fact, very recently, a black female, young black female, won a court case against a restaurant owner in D.C. who is just blatantly discriminating against her and was just so forthright with it and wasn't even trying to hide the fact with other employees who were peers of the waitress who, but yet they were classified as white. But, I mean, he basically said he, I guess the young lady who was classified as non-white was hired when the owner was away. And so he was kind of surprised that she had been hired, and he harassed her, you know, tremendously, immediately, and was just very blatant. And so this is all, you know, 2015, I think it was just a few months ago. And, you know, it's an upscale restaurant, and he basically said he didn't want waitresses that look like that, and he didn't want, you know, clientele that looked like that. So.
Wow. Be explicit about things. Wow. What are some of the things that over the decades that you were able to attend the Welsing Institute that have evolved, like things where you can say, this is something that she emphasizes more now. This is a change in something that she really tries to make sure that her students grasp about white supremacy, racism, that maybe she wasn't emphasizing before or wasn't addressing as much.
You know, tell you the truth, she was very consistent on the basics. I mean, she, and some people would complain that she talks about the same things over and over. It's because we haven't gotten the fundamentals. It has to be, you know, repeated at the basic level. You know, people want to get to, yeah, but what are we going to do? I'm tired of talking about it and analyzing the question, the issue. What are we going to do? If you have a comprehensive and thorough understanding, then your behavior will be reflective of that. And, you know, we largely still need reinforcing all the time. But certainly black self-respect is the key for us. Justice will be a byproduct of self-respect, black self-respect. So that's what we have. That's our predominant project, to cultivate black self-respect. You know, she used to draw a diagram of like a pyramid shape being the roof, and that represented the system of white supremacy. And then she draw two pillars holding up this this rooftop. And one pillar is white intent to survive genetically. The other pillar is black self-hatred and rejection of black self-respect. And so we know that we have centuries of historical evidence that proves that we're not going to convince, demonstrate, protest, or pray people who classify themselves as white into not practicing racism anymore. We know that. We're clear on that. Our opportunity to eliminate the system of white supremacy is on that pillar that we control. So cultivating black self-respect, once we do that, we will stop propping up the system of white supremacy, because as the vast and overwhelming majority of people on planet Earth are black and shades of black, the only way this small minority can control and dominate the whole world is because of the assistance it's getting from those that are classified as non-white. And so cultivating black self-respect, that's our main project. And that entails embracing black, meaning loving and appreciating the fact that you are created, that we are created the way we are as black people. And it means getting out of the fantasy zone of, you know, I don't want to think about this, I don't want to deal with that, embrace reality. And the reality is that we're living under a system of white supremacy. You can't change a thing if you don't admit and acknowledge that it exists. So cultivating black self-respect, that's key. And then, you know, getting an understanding, a clear understanding of the system of white supremacy. And so with an understanding, there are certain things that you're not going to do, not just in terms of your own behavior with other non-white people, but your expectations of what will happen under the system will shift. I mean, it's like, you know, if you understand the nature of a baby, then you're not going to get all upset because the diaper needs to be changed or because there's going to be a lot of crying. If you understand it, you know how to react to that, whatever scenario there is. So I think the message didn't change. The emphasis was probably more and more on self-respect because the system has upped its game in black image defamation to a tremendous extent as we're in the refinement domain of the system of white supremacy. And so it's even more imperative for people, black people and other non-white people, to understand that and to cultivate self-respect because, you know, it used to be that just, you know, you could point to a few people who were kind of behaving in ways that were disgraceful to the collective group. But now it's so commonplace when it comes to parents and families, when it comes to couples, when it comes to how we present ourselves in public, and certainly what's not only in the music, but even worse, on television. That should even give us a clue right there. There's so much time, energy, money, and effort by the white supremacists to tear down the image of black people and then broadcast that worldwide. That should give us a clue about how important black self-respect is.
Context of white supremacy. Our guest, Sabrina Johnson, say that is one thing. I think it would be hard to hear or read Dr. Welsing's work and miss the importance, the huge priority she placed on black self-respect. I know one thing that came up when we had her sister, Lauren Crest Love, on the program, black mental health, and specifically Dr. Welsing, she also emphasized, I think partly because we do not have black self-respect, that no black person qualifies for black mental health under the system of white supremacy. Just can you kind of give some of your thoughts on that? I suspect that's something that you heard her share often.
Yeah, and I think people kind of misinterpret really what that means. I think she was getting at in terms of having mental health. You can't be in a fantasy zone and pretending that something that exists in every aspect of life is just not there. It's almost like if you walked into a fine upscale home and people are standing around in the living room with the fine china and, you know, $8,000 bottle of champagne and caviar and whatever the finer things are supposed to be, and they're in their cocktailware, etc. And then there's this huge pile of vomit in the center of the floor, and nobody's doing anything about it. It's like, how can we say that those people are healthy if you are carrying on with this gross, heinous system functioning that affects all of us directly and all of those that we see and interact with? If we're not recognizing it and then making a decision in favor of your own preservation, then we don't have mental health.
Agreed. I definitely think that was one that also, I think, should impact the patience that we have with other black people, recognizing that we have been extremely abused, terrorized under this system, and just having that patience with other victims. I think that was something Dr. Welsing not just emphasized, but I think that's something that she demonstrated on a regular basis, having just, I won't say infinite, but I mean high levels of patience with other black people, just based on her understanding of racism. And I think also just her high levels of black self-respect. I think a lot of that was demonstrated with the patience that she had for other black people, Gus T. Renegade included.
And let me just add that, you know, even in a clinical setting, exercising a tremendous amount of patience and just the drive to understand. I'm sure you know that the subtitle of the ISIS papers, the origin of that, when she was working as a psychiatrist in a community clinical setting, the police brought a man to her who was just, you know, rambling and, you know, incoherent and all of that. And she, you know, sat and listened to him and, you know, through all of, she called it, he was speaking in symbolic language, as she put it. And, you know, she made the diagnosis, schizophrenic reaction. But then she thought, you know, I'm going to sit here and I'm just going to listen and see if I can, you know, see what he's saying, what he's talking about. And at the end of this very lengthy, sort of almost gibberish, I don't want to say tirade, but this continuous stream of communication, the first and only coherent thing he said was, "Doc, if we could just get the keys to the colors." And that was the origin of the subtitle of the ISIS papers. And so again, exercising extraordinary patience and a true determination to understand in order to help the person who needs help. I think that's a tremendous example of just that.
Absolutely. I'm going to nab some of the folks that called in with questions. Just two other points I wanted to make sure that I brought up. I guess before I even get to my question, just from the gun illustration that you brought up earlier, I thought it was, after I had a moment to think about it, the cookie cutter or whatever, you can make pancakes or cookies in the shape of a gun. When you said pancakes, I was like, wow, if they're making pancakes in the shape of a gun, that's fascinating, because I think people generally or frequently use Aunt Jemima syrup with their pancakes. That's kind of, that is interesting and in line with Dr. Welsing's theory as well, I think.
True. Good point.
For sure. With one of the things that I think is just incredibly significant, we talked about this with her sister, Lauren Kress Love, and she, I mean, wow, gave a priceless anecdote about the significance of natural hair and her being the first one that kind of went natural and the impact of that and why she did it. Just can you talk, it doesn't matter where you see Dr. Welsing, if you see her debating William Shockley some years ago, or if you see her in Hidden Colors more recently, anytime that you see Dr. Welsing talking about racism, white supremacy, she has natural hair. Can you talk about the symbol or just the monumental significance of that, particularly for black females, seeing this black female with natural hair talking about white supremacy?
Yes. Well, even, again, going back, the Creator made us the first people, black people, and all other people sprang forth from us. So the Creator put all of these very interesting substances and characteristics in us and with us. And so there is great significance to the helix, and we know that scientists now know that the shape of the DNA molecules, it's the helix. And so Dr. Welsing often talked about the hair and the helix shape serving as an antenna for picking up frequencies. And so if we are number one, damaging that capability through "quote unquote" straightening and chemical warfare, really on our own heads and minds, then we're diminishing our capability to function effectively with something that we've been gifted with. Number one, number two. You have, it's if you really think about it, what black females are saying as we straighten our hair and perm, so-called perm, which is really temporary, our hair, is, I want to look like an imitation white girl. I mean, there's something of that, I think, coming forward. Why not save money and certainly save your health and well-being by wearing your hair in its natural state? Now, a lot of sisters, if they become pregnant, they will stop getting relaxers or perms, etc., touch-ups and all that sort of stuff. Now, if you stop and think about the science behind that, there's an admission that it's unhealthy, because if it's unhealthy to put these chemicals on your scalp because of potential impact on the unborn child, then that means it's harmful to you, the person, even if you're not pregnant. But we're not in understanding of the context that we're functioning in, and it's it's an indication of our lack of understanding and our lack of self-love and not having appreciation for the gift that we've been given, that we did not earn.
For sure. Just you use the term appreciation. I think one of the things that we can, should be doing, appreciating the monumental effort that Dr. Welsing invested in trying to aid, care for, heal Black people, victims of white supremacy. You said that one of the things that you think is really important, the way that we think about and things that we're doing to preserve the legacy of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Just can you speak to that? What are the things that we should be doing? And even can you talk about your own efforts to continue the Cress Welsing Institute?
Sure. You know, I said in my remarks at the 40-day ceremony, ascension ceremony for her in February 11th, that was, I said that, you know, we should function as an echo of Dr. Welsing so that her message reverberates, and that her voice is expanded and elevated and amplified. And as you have noted time and time again, which is tremendously, tremendously important, she has left a mountain of materials, her words, those powerful words that she's put on the pages of papers, in speeches, essays, books, and her voice. There's so much, and we have to, in everything that we do, amplify that, make it available, point towards it. And we've tried to do that in all of the tributes and the remembrances and programs and all the things that we've been doing. We always want to have a component that includes Dr. Welsing in her own words, so that her voice is carrying her message. I mean, it doesn't even need touching up. I mean, her words, let them stand. Just make them available to others. I think there are a number of things that we can do very specifically. Number one, commit to memory, the functional definition of racism. Also, practice the what was originally known as the 10 stops that were expanded, the behavior code for Black self and group respect. To read, turn off the television unless you are monitoring something with a critical eye. Read, and cultivate Black self-respect. And have an agenda when you interact with other people. So, you know, as I said, the Cress Welsing Institute, a lecture series and an information exchange, opportunity for questions and answers, and really free psychotherapy for all those years. Now, before the Cress Welsing Institute took the shape that it's had for the last couple of decades, you know, Dr. Welsing and Mr. Fuller, when she was working at Howard, she would have, at the medical school, she would have Mr. Fuller come and speak every Monday night from 8 p.m. to 1 in the morning. And they were, you know, formulating their ideas and, you know, just talking and reasoning through and, you know, sharpening up what eventually became the United Independent Compensatory Code System concept, and meanwhile she has formulated the Cress theory of color confrontation and was doing the essays at the National Medical Associations and finally collected them and publish them in the form of the ISIS papers, etc. So there's longevity there, and one thing that we need to think about is, this is a long battle. We're in a war, and so we have to think about things from that perspective. One of the other comments that I made at the 40-day ascension ceremony, I said embrace black. And I also said embody calm and have something in our lives that helps us constructively release some of the stressors so that we can then function at a calm level. Because you have to if you're playing chess, and we can envision that we are in a big way. You do need to be calm, and we saw her exercise calm, even in her debates with Shockley and on the Phil Donahue show, and when she was on the Ron Reagan show with the Aryan Nations guy. The white supremacist Tom Metzger, etc. So from a position of calm, and it's certainly better for our health too. But I envision a big part of my role as clearing the way, moving the obstacles that might be positioned between black people who and other non-white people who don't yet have an understanding of the system of white supremacy and Dr. Welsing's and Mr. Fuller's body of work. So I think there are a number of psychological barriers that it's a wall that goes up maybe when you first hear some of the concepts, like the term victim, that turns a lot of people off and turns them away because we don't understand context. I remember reading in the code, I hadn't yet read the full code, Neely Fuller's book, but I think when I first got it, I just kind of paged through a little bit. And I happened onto a passage that said, white people are the smartest people. And immediately I was like, because I've been in the classroom with them since kindergarten. And, knowing from our own experiences or what we've encountered when we've shared information with other non-white people, all of those things that might serve as barriers, if we can, put them on the table and then sort of explode the myth so that people can embrace the body of work, without delay when they're being introduced to these concepts and this analysis. So I think focusing on removing these psychological barriers and helping people to just incrementally understand the logic in a gentle way so that you're not offending people. We just need to have a critical mass of people, non-white people, understand at the fundamental level, the system of white supremacy, what it is and how it works. And then we can do the ultimate goal objective of producing justice, eliminating the system of white supremacy, and replacing it with a system of justice so that we can have peace. So sharing her work, that's the greatest thing that we can do, and coming together and doing it. So, we had that, the lecture series setting, but it doesn't have to be something as large and formal as that. So years ago, in fact, after the Race Relations Institute at Fisk University, the 33rd Race Relations Institute, wherein I interviewed the self-described white supremacist, older white female, Farrell Winfrey, I invited some of the Welsing Institute students and Dr. Welsing and Mr. Fuller over to view it. And from that point on, I said, wow, you know, it's great to be in a small setting and able to discuss these matters. So I began on the, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King's holiday is celebrated on the third Monday of January. So the Sunday, the day before, I decided, you know, and Dr. King said he wanted to be remembered as a drum major for justice. So I said, that's going to be the justice gathering. So Dr. Welsing and a number of students from the Institute and Mr. Fuller and I would meet at my house, and we'd just talk and basically share and do the same things we were doing at the Cress Welsing Institute in a home setting. Sometimes we'd view videos of documentaries or something that we've of interest. We'd share news stories and discuss agenda items. I'd, you know, prescribe an agenda or maybe a book to discuss, et cetera. And everybody can do that. Any and everybody can do that in whatever setting, you know, they operate in. We have to talk about the system and what it is and how it is functioning and affecting our lives. There's Mr. Fuller often talks about, you know, the seeds of destruction of the system are contained within the system. So as we see the shift from the refinement stage of white supremacy, meaning, you know, everything's covert and, you know, there's a lot of showcasing of quote-unquote black success on the 1-2-3 level, but not in terms of the masses, et cetera. As the shift is moving from that back to the brutal establishment phase tactics, I think young black people are waking up more and more so. So it works, I don't quite want to say in our favor, I just want to say that it can help push us towards a greater understanding, a greater number of people who are classified as non-white, understanding that people who classify themselves as white have an agenda that they are absolutely unified on. And we see it in the political arena these days, for sure. In fact, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today, Angry White Males Propel Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Many presidential primary voters feel free trade has marginalized their jobs and prospects. Of course, they're not going to quite come out and say what it really is in terms of their level of desperation. They're going to blame it on free trade and jobs. But basically, white males in particular are feeling extraordinarily desperate. And so I think that you focused on some of your past shows on the heroin epidemic and the new law enforcement response or non-response to those outbreaks and the legal latitude that's given to suburban white kids who are caught up in heroin big time, with over 90% of the new cases of heroin addiction in the last decade occurring in white youth and young adults.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have an article I want to get your thoughts, because I think it highlights a lot of Dr. Welsing's theories and a lot of what you just touched on with the election. And I want to nab some of the folks who dialed in who have questions. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have a question for Miss Sabrina Johnson. Caller Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Sabrina? You should be with us, sir.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to you, Gus. Good evening, Sabrina.
Good evening.
I had two questions for you. This one's real quick. Can you give us an example of you witnessing Dr. Wells interacting with white people who challenged their views on white supremacy?
Yes. There were a few instances where white people would come to the Institute meetings. And of course, the Dr. Welsing's dialogue didn't change at all, of course. In one instance, a white female called her at her office the following day and left a message on the answering machine that, after your lecture, my brain was popcorn, which is, interesting. There was an instance where a white female came there, and through a series of questions, it was revealed, although she said she was married, actually, she was there with her so-called husband, her white husband, who was sitting next to her, and she was talking about how attracted she is to black males, which is very interesting to say that, when your so-called husband is seated next to you. We kind of reasoned later that, that was a farce, actually, and they were just trying to be disruptive. But Dr. Welsing would ask questions and allow people to talk and just basically, take the stage, so to speak, and shut them down, because people who classify themselves as white will talk about racism to an extent. However, when it comes to the genetic discussion, the discussion about fear of white genetic annihilation, their vulnerability, somehow that never really takes shape, which brings to mind that I do want to mention this, because there are a lot of black people who are on the hype wagon with Tim Wise. Dr. Welsing and Mr. Fuller and a few of us Institute students went to Fisk University's Race Relations Institute both in 1998 and the year 2000. And Tim Wise was there. At that time, he was a pretty ragged-looking person. And while he would say things that were critical of white people and white people's treatment of black people, he also did a radio spot, and he said something very insulting something about Dr. Wellesley. He basically said she talks some psychobabble bullshit. So that was one indication. Another indication is that he spoke with me, and he spoke with Mr. Fuller, and he spoke with Dr. Wellesley. And he told each of us different stories about his background. So, you know, that in and of itself tells you something, too. There were a lot of incidents at the Race Relations Institute that led us to conclude, and these were at Fisk University in Nashville, led us to conclude that he was, you know, an agent being placed there to be disruptive. And we, because of counter-racist codification, because of Dr. Wellesley's analysis of what drives the behavior dynamic behind white supremacy, you know, it was, we helped a lot of people understand what was going on, and we could stand firm against the assaults on our understanding of racism, white supremacy. There was a lot of attempts to derail the conversation and the understanding of racism, even at a conference that is to discuss racism. So we all concluded that Tim Wise was just a provocateur. And so he kind of was out of sight for a number of years. And then he reemerged and started being on the lecture circuit, speaking in black churches especially, and all over the web, et cetera, publishing a number of books with titillating titles and talking bad about white people. Number one, he calls himself a white supremacist, so we have to listen to that. But secondly, when he reemerged, he took on the persona and the swag of a black preacher, you know, in terms of how he, not only how he dresses and presents himself, but the manner in which he speaks, the cadence, the whole emotional hot button words. So he's fit himself into that that black preacher mode, which is, you know, even more dangerous for people who are already programmed as victims to look for and desire a white savior. So I just wanted to note that, and we have to be very wary of more of those. If there are white people who classify themselves as white who are truly committed to eliminating the system of white supremacy, then their work is not dealing with black folks or talking to black folks. Their work is dealing with stopping the white people who are practicing racism. So we really have to get out of that white savior mindset.
Yes, I agree with you. I think everyone who listens to this show has come up with a very similar analysis of Tim Wise as well. I think he's a white validation drug dealer, in my opinion. But my next question for you, and I just wanted to get your analysis, your Wellesley analysis. We have a little thing that we call on this show a Wellesley moment, and I had one watching the political theater, and I was watching one evening, and you guys both touched on it. Both of you guys gave a pretty good example. I saw Vic Rubio, and he was attacking Donald Trump, and he went at him by attacking his hands and saying, you know, he has small hands, so, you know, the running joke with that. And Trump came back with a press conference saying, you know, these hands aren't small. You know, these hands can hit a golf ball 285 yards. And I always just hit me with Welsing, like, you know, she always said the white people played the ball with a little white ball that goes into the black hole. You know, and that's just what he pushed out. And he also made a comment, which I think is causing him the election right now, where he went at Trump's color. And he said he'll be the commander in chief and went at the orange color. And I just put myself in that mindset, thinking genetic annihilation. You know, I'm sure everyone watching that just automatically said, this little Cuban mother, you know, they know that they have that deficiency of melanin. And I just had another Wells in my foot, genetic annihilation. They know that, you know, and I think it caught on to them in masses, which is why he's not no longer, you know, winning, coming in third or fourth place now. But I just wanted to know your analysis of that. If you thought that was accurate, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Okay, Brother Gus, I was getting some cutout, and I think he said, so I'm going to have you kind of repeat the scenario. I heard that there was an accusation of someone's color.
Correct. I think the first thing he said was Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, saying that he had small hands, and I guess mm-hmm. people have made an association between hand size and genitalia, and Donald Trump came back and said, you know, my hands aren't small, I can hit a golf ball, you know, close to 300 yards, and that reminded him of Dr. Welsing. She frequently talks about the symbolism behind the game of golf. And then the second thing was Rubio critiqued Donald Trump's complexion, and he said that he felt that that hurt him having Marco Rubio, who is associated with the area of the world known as Cuba, having him question Donald Trump's complexion, i.e. his whiteness, and if you had any thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting, because I noted that Donald Trump's wife, her name and her appearance, her name is Melania, it might be pronounced Melania, but melanin is the base there. And yeah, it does appear that if she were in Nazi Germany, she would be wearing a yellow star. So I think that's interesting, meaning she would be classified as carrying some genetic material that would be undesirable. So that's interesting. Yeah, I think that calling into question his quote unquote purity might indeed have somewhat of an effect. It might. But, you know, Dr. Welsing talked a lot about, you know, the political dynamics as they were unfolding. And, you know, we have to really be prepared and making moves. Maybe a couple of well-placed questions at a Trump rally or for any of the so-called presidential candidates, as a matter of fact. But, you know, might make the difference between who ends up on the ballot ultimately. But whoever does, we're still existing in a system of white supremacy, as we are now with a black president. So, you know, we have to keep doing what we're doing. And our focus is on cultivating black self-respect and helping other non-white people understand and being supportive of, you know, other black people.
Right on. We'll nab our next caller, 5640. 5640, did you have a question for Sabrina? You should be with us. Caller, last four digits, 5640. Did you have a question? I heard some noise from your line, but I'm not hearing a question. If you're just listening, that's fine. Did you have a question, or are you just listening? Okay. I'll assume they're just listening. If you have a question, you might need to hang up and then dial back in and put your hand up, because I'm just going to assume that you're just listening and mute your line, so we have a lot of background noise. The caller, retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Sabrina Johnson? You should be with us.
Yes. Greetings, Ms. Sabrina and all of the listeners. Mr. Fuller was responsible to me with the what part, what meaning system, global system of racism and white supremacy. Dr. Frank Quest Wilson was responsible for me with the why part of racism and white supremacy. Answer in my mind is codified thought, speech, and action behavior. This work, my question is, this work that you have indicated, and I've also had similar experiences with non-white black people especially, saying, well, let's stop, when do we stop all of the talking and get to work? Would you say that the actual work is thought, speech, and action in a codified way? Would you say that's correct? That is the work.
Absolutely, it's all there in the textbook for victims of racism, white supremacy. It's all there. Yes. But it's not sexy. It's not
right.
Glamorous. It doesn't make you go ooh and ah and wow. It's just trodden through. It's repetitive. It's dry and cold and logical. And a lot of people who would, you know, sit for a lecture from Dr. Welsing aren't really necessarily willing to invest what it takes to read, study, and apply counter-racist codification. Unfortunately, that's just the facts of things now. We're trying to help people understand just fundamentally what the system is and how it works and the actions that we can take. And, you know, there was so much activity in the 90s, particularly amongst a lot of students of the Institute. A number of people were having some very, very significant workplace conflict situations. And we were, you know, working through them and strategizing. And the code works. I'm telling you, the code works.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Yeah, well, last thing is, because in my mind, when I hear this, we need to get to work, it's this grandeur about this large group or large groups of non-white black people, a lot with uniforms on, going about the means of creating some sort of valid force to force white people to stop practicing racism. And with that thought in mind, it's telling me that's probably the last thing that we need to be trying to attempt again. And it is something that they have been quite successful in dismantling, as Mr. Fuller said, within about 10, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The code that we're talking about on programs like this is actually, quote-unquote, the answer. Does it sound correct to you on what I just said?
Absolutely, it is. I'm a witness.
Okay.
I can tell you, using codified language and structuring questions and taking notes and what you say and how you say them and what you don't say and all of those things, raising constitutional questions in the workplace, I'm telling you, I can point not only in the mirror, but I can point to other people who, you know, have been able to accomplish what they were seeking to accomplish when they were aggressed heavily on their jobs. It works.
It really a lot works. Of problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for coming on the program. Thank you very much.
And thank you so much.
Ross, did you have any questions for Sabrina? You should be with us.
Yes, greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Mrs. Johnson. It is an honor to hear you speak. I just wanted to say you are a brilliant example of what studying at the feet of Dr. Wilson can create, the type of person. And it's really an honor to hear you speak tonight. I have a couple of questions for you. Dr. Wilson, on many occasions, spoke either in Proverbs or she would give a lot of examples to explain certain concepts. And I wanted to ask, since you would be there in person on a lot of occasions for the Institute, can you just, because one thing I do know is that in African culture, traditional culture, and as well as ancient Egypt, they would have like a classroom setting where they would teach you with almost like a blackboard setting, and then they would take the students out in nature to show them how these concepts played out in nature to kind of bring it home. And I just wanted to know what effect did Dr. Wilson's use of whether it was proverbs or examples to explain the concepts that she was trying to convey, what kind of effect did that have on the students in her class?
That's a great question. And thank you for your very kind comments also. But, we do very lovely, wonderful, and interesting things with not just language, our words, but how we communicate, especially in African traditions. And yes, speaking with examples that are connected to nature or, you know, proverbs really carries the point, because it's no longer abstract. It's something that's within easy reach and intellectual grasp, no matter, you know, no matter what, because it's basic. It's basic. And so for her to, you know, use metaphors in that way or visual examples is very, very helpful. And it's something that I think we do naturally anyway, if it's not educated or miseducated out of us. That's our natural inclination. And we speak with emphasis, you know, especially, and of course, I would say I'm more keen on this coming from the South, but, you know, we don't just say things in a sort of narrow manner. There's this it's elongated, it's stretched out, it's so that you can't miss it. You know, we won't just say okay, that's useful. And it illustrates this whole albinism dynamic, in that, you know, the albino mutation occurs out of black, and it's, you know, a rare thing relative to all of the other births that happen from color, with color. And so, you know, the notion of not just saying somebody had a dirty house, but
She had so many roaches up in there, it was even some white ones. So, I mean, that's how we talk about things. And so there's that visual element. And while that isn't such a proverb, but it illustrates how it is that we can communicate ideas that, you know, we might have some hesitation or reluctance to accept. But if you make it plain and basic, that's it. And, you know, I find when I think about my grandparents and elders who, you know, didn't have the opportunity to go to school or get much schooling, their ability to transmit ideas and teach fundamental behaviors is phenomenal. And I think it stands tall because they weren't inundated with all of the irrelevant stuff that gets layered on us through the education, so-called school education process. So I think you raise a great point, and I think we should be cognizant of how we communicate these concepts as we're trying to reach other black and other non-white people to lift their level of understanding.
Thank you very much for that answer. And I wanted to ask, do you have offspring?
Yes.
Okay. The reason. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say the reason I was asking was because I wanted to ask you how has studying at the feet of Dr. Welsing changed the way that you reared your children, and what would you say would be the difference between how you think you would have raised them without encountering her information versus how you do raise them now, having that information under your belt and being such as a staunch student of hers. And I'll mute my line. Thank you so much for coming on the program this evening.
Thank you so much. That's a very interesting question. And let me just say this. My quote unquote my offspring are, you know, what's termed stepchildren. So I didn't raise them from birth, but I contributed to their upbringing and into adulthood. And I think that certainly my grasp of the basics of the system of racism, white supremacy, and the various approaches to understanding what's going on helped tremendously in terms of our relationships, our, you know, helping them to see and grow, and I think it's just to help the quality of relationships, all relationships, whether they're parent, child, or, you know, in other kinds of pairings. It's been tremendous. And, you know, you have confidence, but it's confidence that's not from an egotistical framework. It's confidence based on understanding and a lot of humility. And so I think patience, again, is something that Dr. Welsing taught through example. And, you know, that just, it rubs off. It rubs off. And all of the things that, well, I mean, parenting is really psychological manipulation, you know, in the early years, in many ways. I mean, you're trying to shift their attention from this to that, or you're trying to distract them, you know, from this thing that's upsetting to them, and that sort of thing. And you're trying to say things and do things that will incentivize certain behaviors and dissuade them from other behaviors. So, I mean, there's a lot of energy that goes into strategic thinking and, just focus on behavior, one's own and one's a reaction to conflict or to being under attack, that I think is transferable to our relationships, particularly parent-child relationships, once we have an understanding of the system of white supremacy, what it is and how it works, and then also the driving force that motivates the behavior by those who classify themselves as white. Yes, I think that anybody who has a grasp of this analysis and codification, counter-racist codification, will be more effective at parenting and all other relationships than if they were still very confused.
Right on. Caller in Canada, did you have questions for Sabrina? You should be with us.
Well, good evening, Sabrina. Nice to hear you.
Good evening.
Did you all talk about Trump or the election? Because I only caught part of the show. Because I have two questions that are related to that. The first question is, who do you think is going to win, the Democrat and the Republican and the presidency?
Well, I think the first thing for us to focus on is remembering that the so-called Democrats and the so-called Republicans are just separate ends of the spectrum, the political spectrum in the system of white supremacy. And so, you know, in my mind, I describe the Democrats as having you on a 14-foot leash, and then the Republicans having you on a 5-foot leash. And instead of us arguing about or being upset about this leash is longer than the other, our focus should be on, you know, I'm cutting the leash. I'm not going to be on a leash. It's difficult to predict, but I think we can lay out some scenarios. One thing we need to be aware of is the role of technology in our lives and sort of the electoral world. So even if people vote in terms of their sentiments a certain way, that doesn't mean that will be the outcome of the election results. With electronic voting, there is certainly the possibility of great manipulation, mischief, and that sort of thing on the part of the people who classify themselves as white. So, you know, even these polls, you know, at one of the Race Relations Institute meetings at CISC, there was a person from the Gallup family, the Gallup polling family. I think his name was Frank. Anyway, I remember getting into a verbal tussle with him and basically saying, polls don't really mean anything because, number one, you aren't really eliciting information from people. What you're doing is you're imposing ideas on them based on how you frame the questions, number one. Number two, statistically, it doesn't really make sense. you know, if you're saying the majority of people in the United States want to do X, but you've only gotten polling surveys from, you know, a very, very small fraction, then you're just extrapolating, and, you know, it doesn't, where's the accuracy in that? But most important, how does a poll, statistically, how does a poll account for lying? I mean, straight out lying. And we know, under the system of white supremacy, the chief tools used to maintain the system are violence and deception. So there's, and you can't even make real generalizations about lying, because, for instance, I think that, you know, if I asked 100 elected officials, congressional, U.S. congressional elected officials, you know, how old is your grandmother? I think that probably 99% of them would tell the truth. Now, if I asked a question about whether they were having an extramarital affair, and they are, I think that 100% of them would lie, at least initially. A lot of them would hold on to that lie for a long time after that, until they couldn't anymore. So people, you can't make generalizations and attach a statistic to it about, you know, correcting for a margin of error because a certain number of people lie or a certain percentage of people lie about something, because people lie consistently or not so consistently about different questions and different issues. So polling is really just a propaganda tool. It's to have people think that a certain thing is going on, or the level of support of something or someone is something when it really isn't. And we saw that play out with Cruz, I think a month ago or so. His campaign started telling people in one particular state, I don't remember where it was, that Ben Carson had dropped out. And so that had an effect on people who might have voted for Carson. And then the Cruz campaign apologized, and he allegedly fired the campaign person who had done that or started that rumor. But it just goes to show, you know, people can say something and influence, you know, electoral behavior. So I think there's a lot of hype out there. We don't really know what the numbers are for people who are supporting things, but we can listen to their words and read the words of those who are speaking, although we don't know what they're, you know, how many there are. And they're clear. Those Trump supporters, they don't care about anything other than, here is this person who classifies himself as white, who is giving voice to what it is that they wish they could say out loud. And nothing else matters. It doesn't matter how non-substantive he is on the policy questions. It doesn't matter who he insults and offends, whether it's even white women, and the list goes on and on. So I think we should just prepare to do our work of cultivating black self-respect, understanding the system of white supremacy, racism, how it works, what it is, and then practicing counter-racist codification.
Do you have another question, caller in Canada?
Yes. Thank you for answering. I agree with that, because I've always been a bit funny about how I thought about polls. The second question, relating to the sort of what you ended off with, actually, is I get the feeling the more and more that, I guess maybe this could be my own confusion, but the more and more I talk with black people, specifically black people, or maybe it's because I'm in Canada, it's different. And, you know, Canadian white supremacists, I would argue, are some of the most refined. But I find that people don't really want to engage racism seriously until it directly affects them, or until unless it directly, clearly affects them, like a sort of Trump-like person. So I kind of wonder sometimes if maybe that is what's needed, that 5-foot leash to maybe get other people to want to really be truly, deeply committed to replacing white supremacy with justice. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's very harsh medicine, so to speak, but I think it does have the effect of waking people up. I don't say that we would want Trump to be victorious, certainly, but I think along the way we can point to and help people understand the implications of not just what he says, but the people who support him, the people who say he's their guy, and look at where they are, and look at what they do, because they're not all quote unquote blue collar, uneducated, you know, white people from Appalachia. They cover a wide swath. And so, you know, what is it that's sort of the unifying principle with them? If we see that there are people who will support him no matter what, and he's broken all of the quote-unquote taboos, offending, you know, John McCain in terms of a decorated, considered, you know, war hero, having been a POW and suffered torture and all of that, you know, these people are lifted up in this American society, so-called. And he was Trump was very insulting to him. He's insulted women, including white women. And yet, there's something that's not quite explicitly spoken, not quite, that is keeping him, you know, with all the support he has. And if we can just ask critical questions, well-placed questions, with people who we're trying to help understand, non-white people who we're trying to help understand what's going on, at some point, you know, when a question is asked, the brain goes to work on it, even, you know, beyond the moment. And so if we can help black people understand simply by posing questions to them, you know, eventually, hopefully, it'll take root that, wait a minute, okay, this doesn't quite add up. So maybe my assessment of things was not quite accurate. Maybe I can explore something else.
Person that dialed in from a blocked number, did you have a question for Sabrina? You should be with us.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you? Yes, I just had a couple of questions. And, you know, I've been thinking about this for quite some time. I knew Dr. Frances Quest Welding. She was actually my psychiatrist for about a year. I'm a practicing attorney. I've been practicing for over 20 years. And she helped me overcome an employment situation about 5 or 6 years ago. So I'm very grateful to her. And I guess my question has to do with, you know, personally, I'm finding it more and more offensive every day, every year, that I'm sitting next to colleagues. I'm going to court. I'm seeing my colleagues who apparently are supposed to be lawyers just like me. And they classify themselves as white. And they're sitting there taking from me because they're benefiting under the system. And if I'm correct, the system is set up to my detriment because I'm not white. I'm a black person who does not classify themselves as white. Can you equate that to witchcraft? I mean, I know that sounds a little odd, but here you have a whole, you know, class of people, minority people on planet Earth, and their whole existence depends upon my suffering and the majority suffering of people who are not white. And, you know, and they're denying it, they're deceptive, you know, I mean, and I'm just, they're constantly opposing, and I just don't think they will ever change. And I think that unless people, I'm wondering, maybe I should just ask a question. If this system is the most evil thing that has ever existed on planet Earth, the system of racism, white supremacy, can you equate that to witchcraft?
Well, I wouldn't equate it to witchcraft, because then the question becomes, what is a witch and what is witchcraft and by whose definition? And, you know, is there something solid we can agree upon or not? We can assess it as a system, a behavioral system, and a power dynamic. That's clear.
Evil power dynamic. If they're sitting there practicing evil for centuries and thousands of years, isn't that witchcraft?
Well, the whole notion of evil, characterizations like that, you know, certainly one could argue, yes, it's evil. Yes, absolutely. But the question is that helpful? Is that kind of a characterization helpful towards problem solving? And I would say no, because we need to understand things at a scientific level. So just as, you know, research scientists don't talk about cancer cells as being wicked and evil, and they do this deceptively and et cetera. That's not the analysis. The analysis is, well, what is a cancer cell? What is it made of? How does it behave under this set of circumstances? What if we change the cellular structure or the pH or the, you know, whatever? Then how does it react to that?
That's assuming something can be changed scientifically with cancer cells. They're not thinking. But if these people are thinking constantly, and they're always thinking about how to do something wrong and incorrect, I would surmise that, you know, instead of overthinking it from a scientific point, that they are inherently evil.
And okay, so what's your next step?
I guess my next step would be to make sure that all people who are not classified as white recognize that they are evil and that maybe they're incompetent to be, you know, to be in charge of anybody. And maybe they should be ousted of power everywhere.
Okay, and how does that happen?
I don't know. That's the hard part.
Well, again, if you are able to access Dr. Welsing's body of work, her lectures, her interviews. I think CALS has an archive of 31 interviews that she's conducted over the past several years there.
if you give yourself time with an open sense of how you're approaching it, to really listen and say, you know what, I am going to really relax everything that might be in opposition in my mind as I listen and just absorb these concepts and check them with my own sense of logic. We're born with logic. It's there. And the only reason it doesn't function effectively is because it's layered over with a whole bunch of stuff that we can peel away, though. So just listen to her words and read her words and read and listen to Mr. Fuller's as well. The roadmap for our own behavior in cultivating Black self-respect and the actions that we take in relationship to each other and in our encounters with people who classify themselves as white, it's what we can do is all there, and if we
right.
do it, it works.
I'm aware of that, and you know, I've been practicing some of the things that I've gotten out of the textbook that Neely Fuller has written. I guess my last question is, even if you are a non-white person and you do all of those things, that's not going to stop something that is inherently evil from continuing to oppose you. And I think that maybe people who are not classified as white should recognize that in the end, and maybe this thing is going to come to a head. Maybe there is going to be one big war. And maybe it is our responsibility to take these people out. And I'll mute my line.
Well, we're already in one big war, and we have been for centuries. And again, words, definitions of words, very, very important. So when we say war, a lot of people just think of the battlefield scenes that we've witnessed in movies or on film, and you know, somebody's running up a hill and behind a tree and in some thick foliage and in digging ditches and their bodies laying around and all that sort of stuff. The landscape of war under the system of white supremacy appears differently in different areas. There are some places that it is like that, but look, we're at war in America, so-called America. I mean, the war reaches here as it extends throughout the whole globe. We don't really recognize it because we already have a vision in our minds of what warfare is. But no, the war is on right now. Now, in terms of a full understanding of the system of white supremacy, racism, how it works, again, because people who classify themselves as white are a tiny minority on the planet, the way it's being held up and held together is by the cooperation of people who are classified as non-white, because we are lacking in understanding and lacking in self-respect. We help prop up the system. Once we understand, cultivate Black self-respect, then our behavior changes, and it's our behavior change that will no longer prop the system up, and so it will crumble down. And so it's not a matter of saying, you know, we should kill them all, because number one, they are some masters of some guns and weaponry. And number two, there are too many of us who are still so confused that we don't know who to point the gun at. So that's not where we need to be looking in terms of a solution. It's just the basic behaviors, just very, very, very basic. Even those 10 stops and the expanded into the 17 behavior code for Black self and group respect, just that. I mean, people are looking for this grandiose, one of the callers earlier talked about it, you know, this great grand effort. No, just stop gossiping about one another. Stop allowing stop supporting Black image defamation. You know, stop celebrating despicable imagery of Black people, you know, scandal and how to get away with murder and empire. I mean, that's worse than, you know, the raunchiest, degrading rap lyrics. I mean, you have Black women having parties, watch parties, to collectively soak in all of that horrific, it doesn't get lower than that, horrific degradation and base behavior. But just master this simple behavior code, that begins to turn the ship around.
Before we nab our quick caller, just on that point that racism is war, racism, white supremacy is war. Flint, Michigan, not that that's the only place that has poisoned water, but Flint, Michigan, I think Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, I'm pretty sure she would have said that is chemical biological warfare right there, to have a predominantly town that has predominantly Black people. You can't even get basic water that has not been poisoned. I think that's a great illustration of what she was talking about. The caller...
No doubt.
Caller at 9684. Did you have a question for Sabrina Johnson?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say hello what's Sabrina? Is that her name?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I've been listening to this call, and I'm kind of, excuse me, I'm kind of piggybacking on what the last caller said. I know that gets into a little bit of a, it sounded like a discourse that is a little uncomfortable, but I think... what I heard her saying is that we may need to be a little bit more aggressive in dealing with this problem. Because I'm a little confused about, I kind of hear you saying that with these, with this research, which I greatly respect, and Dr. Welsing is a great, someone that I greatly admire, and has helped me to understand quite a bit. But on the same hand, I see an intellectual discussion that we could be having for a very, very long time. And I get a little confused about, are these discussions to help us to navigate the system, or is it to help us put an end to this system? And I also heard a little bit of victim blaming. I kind of heard you say more about what we could do, or that we're doing, and kind of less was said about what people that classify themselves as non-white, I'm sorry, as white are doing. And that gets back to what the lady said before about, you know, kind of categorizing this as some sort of evil entity. And I'm not sure if I ever heard Dr. Welsing conclude where exactly did these, that people that classify themselves as white, what is their origin? Because there's a theory that perhaps they may not be from the so-called indigenous people, you know, that occur, that they call non-white. But I just see a bigger, much, much bigger problem that deserves more than just us discussing and intellectualizing, you know, what's occurring, because there's people that are dying. I mean, it's a very bad situation. And I'm sorry if I've been a little emotional, a little long-winded, but that's all that I had.
Okay, thanks for your questions and comments. I'm glad you brought up this notion of victim blaming. We squarely place the blame on the white supremacists for everything that is messed up in this system, which they dominate and control. It is their fault. All of the messed up behavior that we inject upon and project upon ourselves and each other as non-white victims, we blame squarely, 100%, the white supremacists. Okay, next step, problem resolution. We cannot expect that those who caused all of our mishaps, all of our messed up behavior, to stop, given that they connected with their genetic survival. And plus, even if we didn't quite come to that conclusion, we have centuries worth of experience data that indicates they're not going to stop. So we blame them, the white supremacists, but in terms of solutions, squarely the responsibility for eliminating the system of white supremacy rests on us, meaning those who are classified as non-white. Because we're clear that those who classify themselves as white are not going to stop. Why would they? I mean, if you understand the system and follow the logic, they're not going to stop. So when we talk about black people and other people who are classified as non-white taking charge of their own behavior, that is empowerment, and that is not victim blaming. That is taking matters into our hands and controlling that which we can control, which will have the effect of eliminating the system. So, no, I'm not, and those of us who are coming from that position are not blaming other victims for our problems. This is the system of white supremacy. So I just wanted to clarify that. And in terms of intellectualizing, well, we're talking, we're having discussions, we're exchanging ideas. If you want to, you know, get in the streets and use your body or some weapons to do something to someone, then I hope you've thought it out carefully.
you know, think 360 degrees. What's going to happen if this happens? What's going to happen to this person? What's going to happen to that person? What are the consequences of that, et cetera? I mean, you have free will to do whatever you want. So if discussing and strategizing and using ideas and words and behavioral changes don't do it for you, then by all means, do what's meaningful to you. Hopefully you'll consider whether it's well thought out and constructive and will have you arrive at the desired goal objective, hopefully, and not imperil others, other victims particularly.
Hello?
Yes.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I didn't mean it. I think you may have misunderstood what my point. I didn't mean. I just meant that we. It appears that we are just kind of like babysitting this problem, and we're saying that we want this system to end, but yet we're dealing with an opponent that is very, very aggressive and non-wielding. Refuses to give up, and you know, just very persistent. And I'm not that does not automatically say that I'm promoting violence. I'm just saying that I think. I would like to see our intellectual approach be a little bit more aggressive. And even, I guess you could say, violence does not always have to be like in the form of physical. But I don't know. I just see us babysitting this problem. I'm just like the lady that called before that I think we may need to reassess how we perceive this problem based on what's occurring, you know, the net effect of what's happening to us is black people or people that are not, you know, non-white people. We're being slaughtered. It's genocide.
Sir, I just wanted to ask a question real quick so I can be clear. When you say aggressive, like, what do you mean exactly? What does that mean when you say aggressive?
That's a very good question. I think maybe reassessing who exactly we are dealing with. And then, because... Like, I think if we, I agree with Sabrina that I, you know, to say something is evil is subjective, but I just think that maybe reassessing our opponent, so to speak. And using different tactics to, you know, I understand the codification, but like I was saying, I want to make sure that is not just some way of, or that's not a way of better navigating the system of racism, white supremacy, and not necessarily putting an end to it. And I just had another quick comment.
You get to your comment, I'm still not really clear on what you mean by aggressive. I didn't. It was not really answered for me. If other people understood, that's great. But I still don't really grasp. But if you want to go ahead and ask your other comment, that is acceptable. Or ask your other question.
Okay. Well, I guess what I meant by real quickly. Not so much codifying the, you know, codification, which I perceive as like, you know, better navigating the system, racism, white supremacy. But my question was, I heard Sabrina say, or another comment, I heard Sabrina say that we are upholding the system of racism, white supremacy, and that's primarily why it's still in existence. I just wanted some clarification that she did say that, and that maybe she has some evidence or some research that would, I guess, reinforce that statement.
Well, let me respond again with a pictorial representation that Dr. Welsing shared, and then I'll give it some further explanation. But if you picture a simplistic drawing of a roof, meaning just a triangle or a pyramid shape, and then two pillars holding it up. One of those, the roof is symbolic of the system of white supremacy. One pillar is white intent to survive genetically. The other pillar that's holding it up on the other side is black self-hatred, lack of black self-respect. So indeed, these are the two pillars that are holding it up, and we understand that because how is it that a tiny minority can globally control a majority when the numbers are as they are? It's because there's assistance by the majority. Many of them, it's unbeknownst to them. They don't. There's not an understanding of what we're dealing with. And so, yes, when somebody plays roles that are despicable, and that helps prop up the system. The behaviors that we have that are aggressive towards each other, meaning non-white people, that's helping to hold it up. All the killing that we do of each other, all of the things that precede violent acts and the whole host of things that we do that are not constructive, all of that is helping to prop up the system. And so our point of opportunity and control and power is to grab a hold of our own behavior and change it and make it constructive and no longer hold up this edifice. And something that is being held up by two pillars, when you knock one away, it will fall. And we cannot, will not depend on those who classify themselves as white, who have demonstrated significantly that they will do whatever it takes to survive genetically. Biological warfare, chemical warfare, psychological warfare, you know, every dimension of deception and straight out violence, torture, brutality, savagery, debauchery, everything.
Right on. Caller, I believe this is S Dot. S Dot, if you had a question for Sabrina Johnson, you should be with us, sir.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thanks for taking the call. Good evening, Sabrina. Good evening, Gus, and the other listeners. I had a question for you, but before I get to the question, I had a brief statement that I I've spoken to Mr. Neely Fuller a number of times on his other show on Talktainment. I was a frequent listener to it, and he and I would speak oftentimes. And it gave me an analysis of racism, white supremacy that I oftentimes share with other victims who might be slightly more confused than I am, and I still remain confused. And I think that it might help someone else who may be on the line or maybe listening to a replay of this show, and just tell me if you agree or you disagree. When I think of racism, white supremacy, the way that I think of it is I use the analogy of a club. Race, those who identify and classify themselves as race, as white, are in the VIP section. And all other people who are classified as non-white are in general admission. And anyone who has ever gone to the club knows that those who are in VIP have certain privileges and access that those who are in general admission don't have. And those who are in VIP will never, ever, ever, ever voluntarily give up their access to being on the other side of that velvet rope. And the reason that they have that status and they are looked at in awe is because those who are in general admission have conceded that power to them. Because anyone who has ever been a plus one to someone who is on the list in VIP knows that VIP isn't that special. It's the same club, it's the same drinks, it's the same music. The only difference is they're telling you that you don't have access to it. So when I look at those who are beneficiaries and practitioners of racism, white supremacy, they are very skillful at marketing, and they are marketing an illusion of them having VIP status. And it is because so many of us are on the other side of the rope in awe of them, and so many of us who are on that other side of the rope, whether we want to admit it or not, consciously or subconsciously, desire to be in VIP or to be a plus one in VIP. This is the problem and why we can't realistically address the system for what it is. What happens if you're in general admission in a club and you take away the status that you bestow upon those in VIP and you focus on what it is that you need to do as a person in general admission to enjoy yourself and to focus on what your purpose was in coming to that club, what you then tend to notice is that most of the people who are in VIP begin to start looking over the rope and fleeing from the VIP area and wanting to come into general admission because VIP no longer has its status and its acclaim. And I wondered if you thought that would be a more logical tactic for us as victims of racism, white supremacy, to implement in terms of ways of changing our mindset and our behavior towards dealing with racism, white supremacy. That's my analysis, and then I had a question.
Okay. Well, thank you for your comments, and I think I understand where you're headed with that. And I think that's that could be effective as sort of an introductory way to get people to really kind of open their minds to examining what's going on. I think the limitation would come when we begin to realize that in the system of white supremacy, it's not just the same drinks and music and or the same building decor that we're experiencing.
the reality of the situation is that in general admission, you know, there are a limited number of exits, and there are limited of that limited number versus the capacity, and of that limited number of exits, many of them are not functioning. So when somebody from the VIP section wants to have a little fun and yells fire, there's a major problem for those who are in general admission. Now, in a situation where the building is actually on fire, unbeknownst to the general admission folks, the VIP section, it is coated with fireproof linings, and there are oxygen masks every 3 feet in the VIP section. And there's a special tunnel with a special ventilation system that leads to a safer zone that's part of the design of the VIP section. And so that level of sort of that next level of understanding what the distinctions are being classified as white or classifying yourself as white versus being classified as non-white under the system, it gets into that level of framing just how the system works, because there's not an equality between the general admission section and the VIP section. It is very distinctively different, and the people in, even if things get dull and boring in the VIP section, they're not, and they might come down and mingle with the, slum it with the general admission folks every now and then, certainly. In fact, they do, because it makes them feel better about being VIPs after they shower and return to their section, they're with elevated privileges. But they're not going to just say, you know, I'm tired of being in the VIP section. I think I want to be in the general admission section. And, oh, by the way, I think this VIP section concept is just wrong. So I'm going to dismantle it and make it all one facility. We just don't expect that will happen. And so those are the areas that I would just examine a little bit more closely as I think about your framework. But I really appreciate that it is something that's very relatable to a lot of people, and it's a great path to be on, something that can allow people to attach themselves to something that they can relate to in order to understand something that is either a bit complex or something that they're sort of automatically resistant to embracing. So thank you so much.
Estad, if you have a question, if you could make it concise, because there's somebody else that I wanted to make sure we got in if we have time.
Okay. The question is, in terms of Dr. Wells, and she oftentimes shared her 10 stops, and I often listen to them and try to implement them in my day-to-day life, particularly on social media. What are some suggestions or some practical ways that you could share with folks to implement some of the 10 stops in their day-to-day lives?
Okay. Let me just say, so the 10 stops were developed by Mr. Fuller, and then Dr. Welsing added onto them and framed them as the behavior code for Black self and group respect. But I mean, they're very straightforward. Okay, so for instance, stop gossiping about one another. So if someone comes to you with gossip, you don't have to berate them. You can just very politely share that, you know, I'm really not interested in having a conversation behind someone's back that I wouldn't have in front of their face. So you can say that to the person who's bringing it to you, and then you can also stop it by not propagating whatever gossip that was. So it stops there, and you've given the person something to think about. That doesn't mean that necessarily they'll stop cold right then and there, but you've given them something to think about. They're very straightforward, these stops. So I think that if people are having difficulty with them, it probably means that your self-respect score is in need of being boosted. And so I would say listen to her body of work, read her body of work, and the same with Mr. Fuller. And just embrace Black. Just embrace Black and be calm and think about problem solving and know that you can. I mean, we've been invested with everything that we need in order to solve problems. We've got the brain. It's a problem solving logic instrument. We just got to use it.
Right on. Appreciate that. Estat should be our last caller, a person that dialed in from a blocked number. Did you have a concise question that you wanted to ask Sabrina? You should be with us.
Yes, I did. Thank you. So when you say changing our behavior, are you saying just like a malignant kind of neglect of white people? Because, does that make sense to you? Just to really, really just bow out of their system, just say, I'm not going to be, I'm done. It's, you know, unless I really have to deal with you, I'm just completely done. Is that what you mean by Black self-respect, or what do you mean?
I'm sorry, did you say with respect to our interaction with white people?
Yeah, to just, to just that malignant type of neglect, that kind that kills.
Well, I mean, we have to interact with people. We have to interact with non-white people, and we have to interact, unless you're in a very specialized situation, you probably have to interact with Black people, with people who classify themselves as white. And so you can be courteous and polite with any and everyone. Unless someone aggresses against you, then you take a defensive posture. But just understand who you're dealing with. And with your own self, remember who you are, who you really are. You are a person who is equipped with everything that you need to solve problems that are placed before you. And so you do that, and you know not to blame victims or aggress against victims. You might have to take a defensive posture, but for the most part, your aim should be producing justice, which means eliminating the system of white supremacy, which requires self-respect, Black self-respect.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right on. I think we
nabbed all of our callers. I know the election came up, callers asked about that, and Donald Trump, and you gave some thoughts on that. Thought it would be fitting before we wrap up. You'd mentioned Dr. Welsing, and she read all the time and consistently encouraged us, reminded us reading is more important than watching television. There was an article in the New York Times yesterday, and it's titled "Why Donald Trump Has Done Worse in Mostly White States." And it gives some pretty interesting tidbits. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to try and pick out a couple of the more significant portions and just get your response. Kind of be our last thing before we wrap up. It was a white person who wrote this, Tony Mankovic, I think is how you say his name. It reads, Donald Trump has tended to fare worst in states that are mostly white. This doesn't mean he hasn't had great success in appealing to white Republican primary voters. There's no doubt of that, only that he generally does better in states that have higher percentages of non-whites. They use the term non-white specifically, particularly African-Americans. Mr. Trump's stance on, say, trade and Social Security can strike a chord with voters, but studies have shown that his bigger appeal is as an authoritarian voice of the voiceless. Part of that has been rallying people, particularly those who haven't gone to college, who feel a resentment towards racial, ethnic, and religious others. As Michael Tesler and John Sides wrote for The Monkey Cage at the Washington Post last week, 50 years of research backs this up. Ethnocentric suspicions of minority groups in general and attitudes about blacks in particular influence whites' opinions about many issues. I'm skipping down a little bit. An appeal to white identity tends to work better in areas where that identity is felt to be under threat. The South, where Mr. Trump has performed well, has long been known for racially polarized politics. Race essentially predicts political affiliation there, with blacks lining up for Democrats and whites for Republicans. A state like Mississippi, whose population is around 37% black, is an obvious example. If even 25% of white Mississippians voted for Democrats, the state could tilt blue and perhaps elect the state's first black governor or first black senator since Reconstruction. That is not the case. Just give it down. The numbers have long been locked in. For example, according to the 2012 Mississippi exit polls, 96% of blacks voted for President Obama, but 89% of whites voted for Mitt Romney, who won by 55% to 44%. Political scientists have written about the importance of tipping points in ethnic strife or resentment around the globe. It occurs when one group grows big enough to potentially alter the power hierarchy. Mark Potok, senior fellow from the Southern Poverty Law Center and previous guest on The Cows, has said that demographic change in this country is the single most important driver in the growth of hate groups and extremist groups. He wrote last month, Donald Trump's demonizing statement about Latinos and Muslims have electrified the radical right, leading to glowing endorsements from white nationalist leaders such as Jared Taylor and former Klansman David Duke. Mr. Trump's anti-immigration language lands with force for people who fear the browning of America. Within 3 or 4 decades, several reports have indicated non-Hispanic whites will no longer make up a majority of the United States population. The social psychology researchers Maureen Craig and Jennifer Richson, working at Northwestern, studied whether people could become more politically conservative if they felt a threat to their status in the racial pecking order. The last tidbit that I'll read, they picked out some correlations. One of those correlations, one of the bigger predictions of support for Mr. Trump is the belief that affirmative action is taking away jobs from whites and handing them to blacks. It goes on to give a few more tidbits. Any of this remind you of Dr. Welsing's theory or any thoughts on what she might say to a piece like this?
Oh, absolutely. It's classic. And it makes sense that
states or areas that where people who classify themselves as white are in proximity to those that they classify as non-white would really, you know, jump on the bandwagon. It makes sense. This sense of threat. And by the way, this whole notion of the browning of America and quote-unquote minorities are going to be the majority by 2050 and all of that, it is my view, and if you do a little back-of-the-envelope calculation, that is already the case, that non-white people outnumber those who are classify themselves as white in this country. And if you think about like a state like Montana or Wyoming, I think Wyoming, the state population is like 600,000. That's the size of like Washington, D.C. population, which is a tiny 4x4 square mile place. But think about those states, Idaho, Wyoming, and places like that, and their total population is just a small, and they're mostly white populations, a small fraction of what we see in most major urban areas, whether it's New York, Philly, L.A., Oakland, Houston, you know, on and on. So it is my view that people who classify themselves as white are already in the minority in this country, certainly on the globe, but in this country. The other thing that brings to mind, some years ago, this was sometime prior to 2000, because that was the census was coming up at that time. I went to a seminar that the Census Bureau was having because they were promoting the fact that they were expanding the classification categories on the then upcoming census. And so they talked about the actual, you know, statutory language and their whole decision-making process about what the category should be and what the language should be, et cetera. Interestingly enough, there is an actual prohibition in the law from any official governmental publication, or at least there was at that time, from using the term non-white. And I actually, a few of us went to this, a few Welsing Institute students went to this seminar, and that was one thing that I took from it, and I shared it later on with Mr. Fuller, and he was, he found that quite interesting. And we all concluded that just confirms that's the terminology that we need to use, non-white. So I think Trump being popular with people who classify themselves as white who have to look at non-whites every day, it just makes sense. It just makes sense.
Mm-hmm. The concluding paragraph in this report, which is fascinating, I would encourage folks to check it out. The concluding paragraph reads, Mark Ambender, writing for the Daily News, argued that part of the response to all this should be empathy for working class whites who have been left behind economically and whose resentment has been exploited politically. Consider the most chilling correlation that Mr. Trump is faring very well where middle-aged whites are dying fastest. Reminded me a lot of Dr. Welsing as well, white genetic annihilation. Fascinating piece for some of the I couldn't even read the whole thing. There is a Welsing Institute tomorrow in Washington, D.C., Howard campus. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. We are going to march forward with the Cress Wellesley Institute.
Is it same time, 7 p.m. Eastern at the Blackburn Center at Howard University?
Yes, that's correct.
Outstanding. If you are in the D.C. area, come out, share. You all are exchanging views on white supremacy, racism, constructive information. I'm sure a thought or two on Dr. Wellesley's theory. Is that the type of thing that's going to be happening tomorrow evening?
Yes, yes. We'll continue sort of generally in the same format. This will be the first actual session since her physical absence. Because in January it occurred very soon, you know, just a couple weeks. The second Thursday of the month occurred just a couple weeks afterwards, and we used that time to do a community remembrance of her. And then the second Thursday of the month in February fell on the date for her 40-day ascension celebration. So the Institute didn't meet at that time, per se. And so this will be the first time that we are reconvening without her physical presence. And we're still kind of pulling things together. One thing I did want to mention, your listeners may not be aware that, you know, Dr. Wellesley had two sisters, both of whom have been in Chicago, one for basically all of her life, and then the other had been in D.C. and then moved back to Chicago in the mid-90s. And you had Mama Lauren Cress Love on your show a couple weeks ago. But I don't know if people are aware, but their other sister, Barbara Cress Lawrence, passed away recently also. So we want to give our thoughtful, prayerful strength and healing and comfort energies towards Mama Lorne as she deals with the loss of both of her sisters in such a very, very short period of time. And so as we move forward with the Institute, we're still going to be, you know, working out some matters in terms of, you know, all of the legalities and things associated with the estate when Mama Lauren has the opportunity to focus on those issues. But this monumental body of work, we want to position it to be shared as widely and broadly as possible, and we're, you know, working on structuring things in accordance with that. And so we really appreciate Cal's and you, Brother Gus, for your continued committed and on-point work in terms of helping people understand what we're dealing with and the effective means to direct our own behavior towards eliminating the system of white supremacy and replacing it with justice. So thank you so much.
Thank you for hanging out with us this evening and just sharing some really precise information, remembrances of Dr. Wellesley, and just continuing appreciating her legacy and more than a half century that she spent really trying, as I said earlier, to heal, educate, inform black people, victims of white supremacy, about what this problem is and what we can do to get this solved immediately. Definitely we'll be looking, and I'm sure I'm speaking for... Sorry about that. I'm sure I'm speaking not just for myself, but for many listeners who would definitely want to do anything that we could in assisting the Institute continuing. I know I'm far away miles, but if there's anything that we can do in terms of getting the word out so that people remember, I know we have listeners that are in the D.C., Virginia, Maryland area, that if they are in
town and can visit the second Thursday of the month. That's when the Welsing Institute happens. I think she ran it from September through June, is my understanding, to go and support. If there's anything else that we can do to help, just let us know. I'm sure there are legions of folks who would be willing and able to do anything that they can to help carry on the legacy of Dr. Welsing, as you said, to amplify her voice. So just let us know. I'll be happy to announce on the program and let folks know if there are things that they can do to help in that regard.
Yes, thank you. And there's on Facebook a Welsing Memorial page you can check for updates and things of that nature. There's the Cress Welsing Love Fund that's available for donations through PayPal, and the payee would be CressWelsingLoveFund@gmail.com, or donations can be mailed to the Cress Welsing Love Fund, P.O. Box 55357, Washington, D.C., 20040. And again, we are in the process of doing a lot of things that happen that need to be taken care of as an unexpected departure happens. So supporting us in getting everything situated and our archives set up is much appreciated. But we are absolutely committed to carrying forward on not only Dr. Welsing's cosmic assignment, as she called it, but it's our mission and our work as well. We are thankful for the sacrifice and the example of our ancestors, and we look forward to assisting those yet to come, as did our ancestors for us before we were brought into being. So again, thank you so much for all of the work that you're doing, and I look forward to continued interaction along these lines. Thank you.
Absolutely. We definitely will be looking forward to having you back on the program to just update us with what you all are doing, and I'm sure just to get your views on things that are happening under the system of white supremacy. Hopefully we can have you back as this presidential situation evolves. I'm sure there will be a lot more to talk about with regards to that, and just other strategies, things that we can be doing that have a big impact, meaningful impact that we can be doing to help get this problem solved. But once again, our guest for the evening, Ms. Sabrina Johnson, thoroughly enjoyed having you on the broadcast. And as I said, we'll be looking forward to remaining in touch and helping any way we can continue with the work.
Okay. Thank you so much. I look forward to the same.
For sure. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and we will speak with you soon.
All right. Thank you.
For sure. Good evening.
Good evening.
Sabrina Johnson. Context of yes. White supremacy. Oh, I was just announcing your game again. That's all.
Oh, okay.
My bad. Our guest for the evening, context of white supremacy. And again, thank our listener who hooked us up. He got us the contact information for Ms. Johnson, as well as Lauren Cress-Love. Again, she was with us just a few weeks back. Thanks for folks who have supported, not being spectators, doing what they can to help us out. And I'm sure some people really appreciated hearing from Ms. Johnson and her experience, years of experience, being able to go directly to the Welsing Institute and travel and listen, learn from Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. As I said, definitely be investing our time just remembering and appreciating her legacy, and hopefully applying her teachings. We heard her so frequently, not just on this program, but you know, folks listening to her anytime that they had the opportunity to hear Dr. Welsing speak, to just continue to apply those lessons to help us solve this problem. I think that is what she would want, Dr. Welsing.
With that, we will be here on Friday, continuing Chicago native, the Anita McLean and her book, Book of Collected Essays, A Foot in Each World. This is our second study session. This Friday, we will be going to her notorious essay, How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites, which was published in the early 1980s after the mayoral election. Harold Washington became the first black mayor in Chicago. And I think for Leonida McLean, all of that, again, voting, the election, that seemed to make things very clear for Miss McLean about what it meant to be white. In a system of racism, white supremacy. It is an incredible essay. I'm looking forward to dissecting it, hearing it on the program this Friday, but no more broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Second study session, if you missed last week, it's in the archives. You can be all caught up quickly because we've only done the one session. With that, thanks to all the folks who chimed in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your time and energy this evening, and we will be here again in 48 hours. Again, I encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We want to make sure that we are clear, lucid, so that we can make phenomenal decisions. If you are a driver, passenger, pedestrian, you never know when it's going to be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson that is pulling you over. And can be causing all sorts of problems for you as a non-white person, including taking your very life. You do not want to be in that situation where you are inebriated, not clear thinking. Definitely keep that in mind at all times in all places, making sure our behavior reflects our understanding at some level that we are indeed under a system of white supremacy, racism. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of racism. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.